Next argued case is number 19-1476, Farrow against the director of the PTO. Mr. Farrow.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is John Farrow, appearing pro se in this case. This case involves an attempt to appeal and reverse a suspension by the director of the OED entered in February of 2017.
What's the status of that? Are you currently suspended now?
I've been suspended for 2 years.
You've been suspended for two years?
The suspension was 8 months. But I have elected to continue to fight it because my understanding is if I attempt to get reinstated and am reinstated, it moots this appeal. And I didn't want to do that. I want to try to recover my reputation and reverse what I feel is an improper miscarriage of justice. I'm appealing the suspension under 5 U.S.C. 706 paren 2.
I didn't realize this. I was going to ask the same question, but it strikes me as odd that an 8-month suspension gets continued throughout the period that a party is challenging the suspension.
There were conditions, excuse me,
even though you've served your time, so to speak.
Well, I did not want to moot it. I had taken an ethics exam. I think the Bar Association, American Bar Association, gives an ethics exam, which I have to take if this is not reversed.
Well, I see. But so you haven't fulfilled that.
No, I intentionally have not.
I see. Okay.
Not mooted this. I didn't
mean to.
I'm sorry. Okay. I'm challenging the suspension under 5 U.S.C. 706, paren 2, close paren A, of the Administrative Procedures Act. I'm challenging it based upon an improper investigation. This is a case of first impression. I'm challenging the investigation as not being inclusive enough of information and evidence relative to the grievance. Most of these cases you find are challenging the OED from being overly broad in his interpretation. The investigation is premised on my prosecution of a certain application on behalf of a client that started in 2002. I'm challenging the OED investigation because it didn't comply with the rules, specifically 37 CFR 1122 paren D close paren, which defines the process for conducting an investigation of a grievance. And in this case, and I'll go through that in detail, in this case, not only did the OED director not comport the investigation with the rules, but he also did not comport the investigation with the OED's own interpretation of the rules. When an agreement is filed, the OED sends out what's called a request for information, which includes a copy of the grievance and its form. And the form requires, in the words of the OED, that the OED director must, in his investigation, include in the investigation information relative to the grievance and any information from the respondent which tends to justify, exonerate, or excuse the allegations of misconduct. In this case, that was not done. I'll go into the sequence of the chronology so you understand that better. But in this case, the OED prematurely concluded the investigation, took this incomplete investigation, and went to the Committee on Discipline, got a probable cause determination, and then filed a complaint, institute a formal charge and filed a formal complaint. That was improper.
This argument is that the OED did not have subject matter jurisdiction.
That's how I define it, because the OED director does not have discretion to institute charges and file a complaint against the grievant. That is done by an independent entity within the Patent Office called the Committee on Discipline. So the arguments by the government that somehow the enabling legislation imparts this broad discretion is incorrect. The implementing regulations under the enabling legislation confine and the OED in its role as an investigator. In the Fourth Circuit, this matter has been determined before when the OED director claimed certain immunities in a Bivens case, and the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Goldstein versus Motes indicated that the OED director is an investigator. He's a cop. He doesn't have any discretion in conducting the investigation. The content of the investigation is defined by the request for information, wherein he has to obtain evidence relative to the grievance and any information from the respondent, namely the attorney, which tends to mitigate, justify, or excuse whatever allegations of misconduct have been made in the grievance. He thus prematurely, in this case here, I'll go through the chronology because it's hard to come. The grievance was spawned as a spinoff from a malpractice lawsuit that was filed in October 2013. The malpractice lawsuit bumped along. A new attorney came in May of 2014, and he filed a grievance with the OED. He filed one with the Florida Bar, which was dismissed. It was identical. And the grievance was thereafter forwarded to myself with a request for information that I respond. I did respond. And my response was, quite frankly, very simple. Number one, I advised the OED of the existence of this pending prior file lawsuit. I indicated that there were overlapping issues in both the lawsuit and the grievance, and I requested the OED to abate the investigation. There's no specific limit on the duration of an investigation. There's nothing in the rules that require an investigation be concluded where it's evident that additional information is forthcoming. And so my request to abate was to permit that additional information to be forthcoming. Notwithstanding, the OED never responded to my request to abate the investigation. Thereafter, it proceeded to go to the Committee on Discipline, obtain a PC, probable cause finding, and institute a complaint. This was done in May of 2015. Now, in my response to the request for information, I apprised the OED of this pending lawsuit, which was not done by the grievant. The OED had access to the scheduling order in the federal case. The scheduling order entered in this case indicated the case was going to trial in July of 2015. That's the slip date. So the information that was I assert was forthcoming would have been favorable to me and potentially exculpatory.
Let's assume for a moment that the failure to abate the investigation and the charge was not error by any PTO entity, and that they were free to go ahead with their disciplinary actions regardless of what was happening in the malpractice action or any other action. Setting that aside, what is the issue with the way the PTO went about this?
Well, this was compounded, so I didn't go through the chronology. Okay, well, basically, once they got their probable cause and they started the initiation, the litigation kept going. It was parallel.
But set aside the litigation.
I understand.
The litigation doesn't exist and focus on what the PTO did that, independent of the litigation, you have complaint with.
Independent of what?
Of the litigation.
Which litigation?
The district court litigation and the malpractice action.
They're together.
Well, because I'm trying to get you to separate them.
I can't. The reason I can't do it is because of the overlapping issues, number one.
Okay.
And number two, when the district court entered a summary judgment in my favor and granted my motion in limine striking their expert, it made a number of findings, which are set forth in my brief on page 14. And those findings in striking the expert are material.
Mr. Farrell, let's try this, because I think I found your brief to be pretty thick. It was difficult to separate. It was difficult to separate out the arguments, but I believe that I've separated some out. For example, isn't one of your arguments that you were not afforded a fair and impartial hearing during the disciplinary proceeding.
Well, there's two parts to that.
That's
one of it.
Can you address that? I think that would help you if you were to address that
particular. Part of that issue involves my effort to file affirmative defenses where the findings were made by the district court. I filed affirmative defenses which tended to mitigate, excuse, to justify my actions. The OED opposed that motion to amend. Those affirmative defenses appear on page 9 of the reply. Now, I made that effort, and then the OED director, not the OED director, when they opposed it, the ALJ entered an order saying that those affirmed defenses had no nexus to discipline and denied my ability to introduce.
But you were heard on that particular point. You made a submission, and you were heard on it, and then a decision was made on that.
Heard by who? The ALJ?
By the disciplinary board.
No, I was not heard on it. The information, so that's why I know it's convoluted. The information and evidence that they collected was exclusive of that. It was a premature conclusion of the investigation prior to going to the Committee on Discipline. The information and evidence relative to excuse, exoneration, and justification was never before the OED in the investigatory period. They prematurely concluded the investigation. They got the probable cause finding from the Committee on Discipline and then initiated the complaint. That was done in May of 2015. In August and July of 2015, the district court made its rulings on the dispositive motions and motion limiting. And those findings, which are in the brief, I believe on page 14, those findings were never permitted to be asserted affirmatively in my favor in defense of the allegations of misconduct that permeated the truncated investigation, permeated the entire proceeding, because they objected to the introduction of those affirmed defenses because they said there was no nexus to discipline. That's nonsense. The affirmed defenses that we listed, correspond to challenging the probable cause finding. They relate to mitigation. They relate to the legal objectives of the client, which was an issue in the case. So what had happened is I was constrained in my defense because of the content of the investigation, and the ALJ endorsing that limitation when he rejected my ability to add affirmative defenses asserting those issues. The issues in common out to the malpractice and to the disciplinary proceeding were in fact material to the disposition of this case. I should never have had a probable cause finding returned against me, in my opinion. And certainly, if I had had an opportunity to assert these affirmative defenses, I would have been better off in terms of setting a record before this court. I was denied an opportunity in both cases. So the record was calculated to be incomplete. That's what I'm trying to assert here. It was an incomplete record. I was constrained from making it complete because of the ALJ's denial of my motion for motion to amend, and that appears in the appendix. The motion to amend the assert affirmative defenses appears in the appendix in 630 to 640, and the ALJ denial of that motion appears in the appendix at 1303. So in both cases, it was a 1-2 punch. I couldn't get this information in front of the Committee on Discipline to contest the probable cause finding, and then when I tried to bring it into the merits determination, I was also denied an opportunity to bring it forth.
Thank you. Let's hear from the office. We'll see what they have to say on this point.
I'm sorry?
We'll save your rebuttal time.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Good morning.
It would be helpful if you would take up Mr. Farrow's last point.
Yes, Your Honor. As I understood it, in response to Judge Reyna's question about the fair and impartial hearing, Mr. Farrow identified the ALJ's striking of his various affirmative defenses during the administrative proceeding. I would first note that that this argument Mr. Farrow raises was raised for the first time in his reply brief, in his gray brief. It did not appear in any sort of substantive way in his blue brief. But setting that aside, the ALJ issued a series of decisions that are relevant to this particular point. They appear at the appendix at pages 1301 to 03, and also at the district court administrative record at 1425 to 1429. In essence, what Mr. Farrow argued before the ALJ is that the district court's rulings on summary judgment and regarding the damages expert of Mr. Farrow's former client in the district court matter should stop the USPTO in this separate disciplinary proceeding. The ALJ addressed those arguments, and it found that there is no issue preclusion here for the reasons discussed in those decisions, primary of which is that there was no identity of the parties, no identity of the interests. The USPTO is an entirely separate entity from Mr. Farrow's former client. The PTO has its own independent authority to regulate the conduct of the practitioners who appear before the office, and all of these reasons are laid out in the ALJ's decision. So Mr. Farrow had the opportunity to raise these issues, but he conflates the opportunity to raise them with the ALJ agreeing with his theory of the case.
Well, what's Mr. Farrow's current status right now?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Farrow was suspended for 8 months under this disciplinary proceeding. There are certain notice requirements, notice and application requirements under sections 11.58 and 11.60.
Did that suspension take effect? Was it ordered?
So the suspension was ordered. However, under 11.60C, the suspension period does not actually begin to run until Mr. Farrow complies with the notice requirements of 1158. The PTO reached out to Mr. Farrow requesting compliance with those provisions in 2018, received no response, and my understanding is that to this day, Mr. Farrow has not complied with those requirements. Those are regulatory requirements that go beyond taking the MPRE in this matter.
When you said that the suspension does not start to run, you meant it, the suspension is in effect, but it doesn't. The eight-month period, the clock doesn't start to tick on the eight-month period, right?
That's right, Your Honor.
So he is suspended right now and has been for 20 months.
That is correct.
So that would end if he were to meet these notification requirements?
He would need to be in compliance with the requirements in subsections 58 and 60 for a period commensurate with the suspension itself. So he would need to be in compliance with those requirements for 8 months before he would be eligible to reapply for reinstatement.
All right.
I will also turn to Mr. Farrow's primary argument, which seems to be that the OED director was not allowed to conclude the investigation without first waiting for the separate legal malpractice action to come to an end. As an initial matter, the PTO's broad disciplinary jurisdiction under 35 U.S.C. Section 2 is not in dispute. Mr. Farrow admits that his practice before the PTO is subject to the OED's oversight and that he concedes he's not challenging the PTO's disciplinary jurisdiction. That appears at page 5 of his blue brief, as well as in filings before the district court. Judge Reyna, you had mentioned subject matter jurisdiction earlier, which appears in Mr. Farrow's brief. There is no such thing as a separate subject matter jurisdiction. The question is disciplinary jurisdiction, which is uncontested. There's also no showing that the OED director somehow improperly, prematurely concluded his investigation or otherwise failed to follow any regulations. Here, the OED director gathered and examined all of the evidence that existed at the time of his investigation. He did that pursuant to subsection 11.22D, And he also filed the complaint within 1 year of receiving the grievance about Mr. Farrow's misconduct. That was done under 11.34D. As the district court correctly held at page 8 of the appendix, there's no regulation that requires the OED director to wait for some new information to spring into existence. And that's particularly so because of the one-year filing deadline that's set forth in 11.34D, as well as the general statute of limitations in 35 U.S.C. section 32. I would point out also, as we have in the briefs, that the regulations also provide that neither settlement, compromise, nor restitution with the grievant shall in itself justify abatement of an investigation. These are all straightforward regulations, and they were all straightforwardly applied in this case.
If you look at Appendix 1302, there's a list of 11 affirmative defenses, amended affirmative defenses. Those are those the entire set of affirmative defenses that we're addressing here?
Not quite, Your Honor. That filing with the 11 affirmative defenses was actually the third pleading.
Yes.
Regarding
but,
affirmative
but
defenses.
But I guess my question really is, do those replicate the affirmative defenses raised in the earlier pleadings, or are they separate ones that were raised that are not represented by the 11 that are set forth there?
I believe they do replicate. Okay. There were some that I believe Mr. Farrow may have adjusted some of his wording or the specific theory, but they were presented before.
And was there any one of these defenses that was not addressed by the administrative judge?
No, Your Honor.
Administrative law judge. I guess this is an ALJ.
Right. No, the ALJ's decision, and I would refer you to the whole decision, but also the ALJ's decision in the district court administrative record at 1425 to 1429, where he deals with estoppel and preclusion, that the two of those decisions together address all of the affirmative defenses that Mr. Farrow pled.
Now, remind me, because the ALJ's opinion was lengthy, so did the ALJ address the statute of limitations issue, the change in the statutory statute of limitations in 2011. Did the ALJ address that issue? My recollection was that it was addressed. Was it?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. So the ALJ addressed it in his actual order after the hearing, the disciplinary hearing.
Right.
And I would be happy to look for a site for that. But he did address it. The USPTO director on appeal also addressed the issue and provided further guidance on that.
Right.
Just very quickly on the specific substance of the misconduct findings, the ALJ issued a comprehensive decision that lays out the record evidence in this case and explained the reasons why he made the findings that he did. The district court did the same below. I won't belabor those points here, but rather just refer the court to those pages of the appendix, which are pages 1 to 15 and 107 to 140. At the end of the day, Your Honors, Mr. Farrow disagrees with the outcome of his disciplinary proceedings, but his disagreement is not a basis to reverse the district court's decision or to find lack of substantial evidence in the ALJ's findings. If there are any further questions, I'd be happy to address them.
Are you with the U.S. Attorney's Office?
I am, Your Honor.
Yeah, so welcome to the wonderful world of patent litigation.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Yeh.
Thank you.
On two points raised by counsel, the first one is that the affirmative defenses were based upon some preclusion issue. That's inaccurate. There were two grounds asserted in the affirmative defenses, one of which was that there was a failure to comply with the rules. I think it's the third affirmative defense. And in addition, there was a second ground that there was potentially a defense of issue preclusion because of participation by the OED in the malpractice litigation. So there were two grounds. So they never addressed the issue of whether there was compliance with the regulations regarding conducting the investigation. That's number one. Number two, as far as this is quite important, and this was addressed in the prior case I had on a mandamus, which was before this court. There is no deadline or duration for conducting an investigation. That's inaccurate. The rules specifically provide 37 CFR 1134E, that the investigation, if it can't be completed within a certain period of time, whether it's a statute of limitations issue or some other regulation, that the OED can toll it, can toll the period of the investigation, and then allow whatever additional evidence is forthcoming to be available to it. There's nothing in the regulations that excuse the OED from complying with its mandatory obligations. It has to consider all information and evidence. The OED's own rules interpret that word all, but in the request for information, they have to consider not only information relative to the grievance, but also information relative to exoneration, excuse, or justification. The findings by the district court in ruling on the motions that I had filed, which occurred after May 15th, when he had filed the complaint, are supportive of the affirmative defenses that, number one, I did not, and this was what I don't have time for, in terms of complying with my obligations to pursue the legal objectives, all these affirmative defenses go to that point. The fact of the matter is, I represented these clients for 7 years. My job was to keep this dog alive. This patent application was worthless. The client abandoned the product, abandoned all the foreign equivalents to the application that was before me, and we filed a new patent application on the new product, and new FDA 510K applications had to be filed. So my pursuit of the legal objectives was critical to my defense in this case, and the information and evidence necessary to that defense, specifically the findings by the district court in ruling on the motions in limine and the summary judgment, was excluded from that consideration. So I was prejudiced by the premature conclusion of the investigation. It was premature because the OED was aware information and evidence was forthcoming, which had bearing on those affirmative defenses. He knew also that there was, and he knew that because of the scheduling order, which is accessible to him, setting forth the time for filing the dispositive motions and setting forth the trial date. By prematurely concluding the investigation in May of 2015, he excluded from consideration that information which became forthcoming thereafter, no later than July or August of the same year. So that's the premise here. The premise is here. He turned a blind eye to information that was going to be potentially exculpatory. That process permeated the entire lawsuit, or the entire discipline. When I attempted to assert affirmative defenses based on the findings by the district court in ruling on the motions for summary judgment and in ruling on the motion in limine, I was precluded from doing that by the ALJ because they opposed it and they said there was no nexus to discipline. And the reason there was no nexus to discipline is the OED defined what the universe was for consideration by the ALJ. There was an artificial constraint placed on the performance of the defense here. There was no way of getting information and evidence in defense of myself because it was not part of the universe of the pleadings. The district court in Virginia said something, well, Farrow could have asserted these offenses without having his affirmative defenses. I don't think so. The OED was very scrupulous in objecting to anything that was not within the four corners of that complaint, and had the ALJ prior ruling on these affirmative defenses to back itself up from preventing me from introducing this evidence. The most glaring example of this was, I think that's the best I can do. I mean, I need another hour. I at the Massachusetts bar, I was there for an hour. My voice left me at that point in time.
We must move on. I agree.
Okay. I went over there, Your Honor, because this year is good, this one isn't.
I assumed that was the problem. Yeah. I was saying we must move on.
I appreciate the extra time, Your Honor. Thank you very much for hearing.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Farrow and Ms. Yap. The case is taken under submission.